When the bets were placed, the amazingly deaf dealer started to pull his buttons away from the pile in lots of four. And it was striking how skilled the players were in discerning, while the pile of buttons still contained 50 or 60, what the number left over at the end was bound to be. Using his own and other punty money, Munkai had a satisfactory run at Fantan, and he felt that perhaps the fact that he had been kind to the Hakka girl had brought him good luck. So he took his earnings to the Mahjong room, where the clattering ivory tiles evoked their perpetual fascination. When, at the beginning of each game, the players built their wall, it was customary for them to slam the tiles down with maximum force, creating an echo that accentuated the natural excitement of the game. And likewise, when a player scored a coup and exposed his pieces, he slammed them onto the noisy table. Mahjong, as played in Macau, was a wild, exhilarating game. And now Munkai decided to test his luck at a table where real gamblers played for high stakes. Placing Nyuk-tsin behind him, and twitching the cord now and then to be sure she was still tied, he joined three waiting men. Two had long, wispy beards and costly gowns. The other was more like Munkai, a young, aggressive gambler. At first, one of the older men protested, "I do not wish to play in a room where there is a woman." But Munkai carefully explained, "I am taking her to a brothel in the fragrant tree country, and am responsible for her." This the men understood. In fact, the man who had protested thought, "Probably he will have his mind on the girl and will lose more quickly." But Munkai had not entered the game to lose. Mahjong, unlike Fantan, did not depend so much on luck as on the skill with which one played the pieces luck sent him. And the young gambler, thinking that this might be his last day in a big Mahjong contest, breathed deeply as he used both hands to help mix the 144 tiles at the start of the game. With loud energy, he banged his pieces down to make the wall, and then watched carefully as he rolled his dice to help determine where that wall should be broached to begin the gambling. With intense excitement, he grabbed his tiles in turn and remembered Nyuk-tsin only when he leaned forward to reach the tiles and felt her rope tugging at his waist. When his tiles were arranged, and he had long since learned to keep them in haphazard formations from which his clever opponents could deduce nothing, he was ready to play. But the bearded man, who had originally protested against Nyuk-tsin, said, "She has got to sit on the floor where she can't spy." So before the game began in earnest, the Hakka girl sat on the floor. But this was not entirely satisfactory to Munkai, who was afraid that she might slip away. So he forced her to sit under the table against his feet, and there she remained for the long hours during which the four players slammed down their tiles with great force. From her position under the table, Nyuk-tsin noticed that she could detect when Munkai was attempting some daring coup, holding back tiles in hopes of building them into some fantastic combination that would win him much money. For then his ankles became tense, the little bones stood out, and his feet began to sweat. At such times, she prayed for his success, and she must have been attuned to some powerful god of good fortune, for her man won. At dusk, he tugged on the rope and said, "We'll go home." But as they returned to the dusty streets of Macau, hawkers swarmed about them, attracted by the rumor. The young fellow from the brothel was a big winner. They brought flowers and bits of cloth and steaming kettles of food, and Munkai found real pleasure in playing the role of a generous winner. Fingering the torn cotton fabric of his girl's smock, he said, "This one needs a new dress, believe me." And with grandiloquent gestures that all could admire, he announced, "We will have 4 lengths of that." He was even more generous when it came to food, and hungry Nyuk-tsin had black eggs, dried fish, noodles, and crystallized ginger. As they lounged beneath a dentist's sign, he announced to the crowd, "I am really a very lucky gambler. I can see what's in the other man's mind." As the night wore on, he drew the cord tighter to him, so that Nyok-tsin could not stray, and he bought bits of food for worthless characters he had long known in the Portuguese city. When the civil guard passed by, he nodded to them, and when one asked, "Why do you have the girl tied up?" he replied in the patois of the port city, "I am delivering her to a brothel in the fragrant tree country." The police nodded approvingly, and then one stopped. "Are you sailing on that American ship in the bay?" "I suppose so," Munkai replied. Instantly, the policeman grew confidential and whispered, "I'd better warn you, then. The American who bought you in the village came to us today to have you arrested. You'd better hide." "I'm reporting in the morning," Munkai assured him. "But thanks." And he gave the policeman a coin. "Thank you, Munkai," the official bowed. "That's a nice girl you're taking with you." "She's only a haha, but she brings luck," Munkai replied. Finally, he led his captive back to the brothel of Spring Nights, where he showed his former boss how he had multiplied the 10 Mexican dollars 8 times. "This girl brings luck," he said. "Are you going to tie her up again in the little room?" the proprietor asked. "She'll sleep with me tonight," Munkai explained. "All right," the prudent businessman replied. "But remember what you learned here about breaking girls in. Feed them and beat them." "I'll take care of her," Munkai assured him. "Were the police here for me?" "Of course," his boss replied. "Your ship's sailing tomorrow." "I'll be there." Tugging the cord, he led Nyok-tsin down the narrow hallway, out the back door of the brothel, and on to the hovel where he slept. Locking the door, he untied the rope from his waist, but fastened it even more securely about Nyok-tsin's wrist. She explained that she needed to attend to her bodily functions. So he opened the door and allowed her to go outside while he lounged in the doorway, testing the rope now and then to be sure that she was still secured. When she returned, he said, "Now we must pack for the journey." He had provided a wooden tub into which he jammed his accumulated treasures, a teapot, 5 bamboo cups, 2 good rice bowls, a metal pot, a porcelain tea set with a small copper strainer, a bamboo tray for steaming vegetables, and a large knife. The incense burner, the kitchen god, and the ancestral tablet which proved who he was were tucked into place, followed by his extra clothes and a pair of good sandals. Over this tub, he now tied securely a piece of canvas stolen from a Dutch ship. In a wicker basket, Nyok-tsin packed the food for the trip. Soy vinegar, pickled cabbage, spices, dried fish, seeds to chew on, and several chunks of flattened duck. The implements for cooking also went into the basket. Chopsticks, a charcoal stove, 1 old cup, and 2 old rice bowls. The little room now contained only a bed and a poem. The former would be rolled up in the morning, the latter, which explained the manner in which the names of one key generation followed another, was contained in a red-lined book in which the genealogy was kept, and as the most precious of Ki Munkai's possessions, it would be the last to leave and would be carried by Munkai himself. Surveying the quarters in which he had lived with reasonable happiness, and from which he had moved out to become a skilled gambler, Munkai sighed. Then, seeing Nyok-tsin standing forlorn in the middle of the dimly lit room, he said, "You may undress now." And when she untied her wrist and dropped away her clothes, and when he saw that the cord marks were disappearing from her body, he smiled and indicated that she could sleep with him. Since she had expected to be tied up again and thrown onto the floor, she came to him gratefully and was not afraid when he began quietly to enjoy her. He was the first man who had ever touched her with what could even remotely be termed affection, and she found herself reciprocating. They had a vigorous passage of love, and Munkai thought, "In some way, she's better than my Kung wife." When they were through, he remembered to reach for the cord to tie her to him, but when he took her wrists, she pleaded, "It is not necessary." He was tempted to believe her, but he knew that if she ran away he would not only look the fool, but would also be required to refund the $10 Mexican, plus whatever his boss had paid the kidnappers. So he lashed her wrists to his, but he did allow her to sleep beside him. In the morning, when they were dressed, he finally threw away the rope, for he thought, "If I report to Dr. Whipple leading this girl by a rope, he will hardly believe my story that I am married to her." And on his ability so to convince the American depended the success of this voyage. But when the rope fell in the dust of the little room, Nyok-tsin stooped down and retrieved it for tying her basket of food. When they left the room, Nyok-tsin carried the tub and the heavy basket. Mun Kai carried the feather-light bedroll and the genealogy book. But after he had stepped into the filthy yard behind the brothel, Nyok-tsin called to him and pointed to the wall above where the bed had stood and where a sign now hung that she could not read. Mun Kai whistled at his forgetfulness and recovered the omen of special good fortune. "May this bed yield 100 sons." Tucking it under his arm, he led his woman to the waiting ship. At the quay, Dr. Whipple stood ready to berate the only man he had who could converse with the Hakka, and as soon as Mun Kai appeared, the Cantonese interpreter started shouting at him, but he ignored the man and marched contritely up to the American. Bowing his head in feigned apologies, he said softly, "I am 1,000 times humble, sir, for having run away." Then, producing the overburdened Nyok-tsin, he said simply, "I had to find my good wife." "Your wife?" the interpreter stormed. "No women are allowed on this." Dr. Whipple, noticing the girl's big feet, asked, "Isn't she a Hakka?" "Yes," Mun Kai replied. And the American scientist, remembering how he had once idly considered the desirability of importing some Hakka women to Hawaii, asked, "Do you wish to take her with you?" When this was interpreted, Mun Kai piously nodded and explained, "I could not bear to leave her behind." "I'm willing to try it," Whipple announced. Then he warned Mun Kai, "But when she gets to Hawaii, she's got to work." "She'll work," Mun Kai assured him. At this moment, the 150 Hakka men saw Char Nyok-tsin for the first time since her abduction on the eve of Qingming, and they began to cry to her. And Mun Kai knew that if they explained who she was, his fanciful story would be exploded. But he also realized that no one on the quay but he could understand what they were saying. So he nudged Nyok-tsin and told her, "Speak to them." Pushing her toward the Hakka, he followed behind and cried to the men, "This girl is my wife." And the Hakka saw about his waist a red marriage belt, and they began to wonder what had happened. "Are you indeed married to the Punti?" they shouted. Mun Kai jabbed his girl in the back and whispered, "Tell them you are." So Nyok-tsin informed her countrymen, none of whom had ever befriended her after her parents' death, "He is my husband." And the Hakka looked at her in scorn and would have no more to do with her, for their parents had often warned them about what had happened to the disgraceful Hakka girl who had married a Punti man in 1693. This problem settled, quick-thinking Mun Kai now faced one far more serious, for Dr. Whipple was calling through his interpreter for the married couple to join him. But when Mun Kai and Nyok-tsin started to do so, they had to pass through the Punti contingent, and these men were even more outraged at Mun Kai than the Hakka had been. They, too, had been well-drilled in the evil that had befallen the Punti man who had dared to marry a Hakka girl back in 1693, and they drew away from Mun Kai as if he were unclean. But as he passed each group, he muttered to those from whom he had borrowed, "Last night, big winnings, lots of money for you." And this softened their anger. When he reached Dr. Whipple, the American said, We will have to ask the captain of the ship if he will accept another passenger, and if he says yes, you will have to pay passage money for your wife." He therefore sent a sailor in search of the captain, and in a moment a towering American loomed among the Chinese, a man in his 70s, with stout muscles and a sea cap jammed on the back of his head. He had fierce, dynamic eyes, and looked at the men about to board his ship, as if he hated each one of them with deep personal anger. Brushing them away as he strode through their groups, he came up to Whipple and asked, "What is it, John?" "Captain Hawksworth," the trim, gray-haired scientist began, "I find one man who wants to bring his wife along." "You willing to pay $5 passage money?" Hawksworth asked. "Yes, I'll get it from the man." "Then it's simple," the captain growled. "She can come." Dr. Whipple conveyed this news to Mun Kai, who grinned happily, explaining to the interpreter, "A man would not like to leave his wife in Macau." Dr. Whipple was impressed by this sentiment and asked Captain Hawksworth, "Where will the couple sleep?" "In the hold," Hawksworth snapped, with some surprise that the question should have been asked. "Where the hell do you suppose they would sleep?" "I thought," Whipple began, "that with her the only woman and 300 men..." "In the hold," Hawksworth shouted. Then, addressing the Chinese, who could not possibly understand him, he roared, "Because when this ship sails, I don't want to see one goddamn Chinese anywhere but locked up in the hold. I'm warning you." "Rafer," Dr. Whipple began again, "in the case of this couple, couldn't they stay with..." Captain Hawksworth turned quickly, pointed his long forefinger at his missionary friend, and snapped, "They'll stay in the hold. How do I know this rascal isn't a pirate? How do you know he's married? There'll be no pigtail Chinese anywhere on this ship except locked up below." Reluctantly, Dr. Whipple explained to Mun Kai that if he insisted upon bringing his wife along, she would have to share the hold along with 299 other men. But to his confusion, Mun Kai evidenced no surprise. And Captain Hawksworth observed, "It's nothing to them. They live like animals." The moment had now arrived when the Chinese were to board the Carthaginian as it lay alongside the Macau quay, and Portuguese officers in brilliant uniforms took their places at the gangplank, checking off numbers rather than the names. The Cantonese interpreter said farewell, and the 300 Chinese men and their one woman were left alone in two hostile groups, Haka and Punti, with no one who could converse with the Americans who ran the ship, and with only one man, Mun Kai, who could make himself understood to both contingents. However, their thoughts were diverted from their plight by the natural excitement involved in climbing aboard the schooner from whose mast flew the blue H&H flag. When the first Chinese stood at the top of the gangplank and saw before him the great open ocean, he hesitated in natural apprehension, which was increased when a sailor grabbed his pitiful store of belongings to stow them aft. The Punti started after his precious bundle, but he was halted by Captain Hawksworth, who grabbed him by the pigtail, spun him around, and with a forceful kick sent him stumbling across the deck. "Get down into the hold, you stupid Chinee," Hawksworth roared. And when the uncomprehending Punti stood in bewilderment, the captain kicked him again. The Chinese staggered backward toward the open hold, missed the ladder, and plunged headfirst 14 feet into the dark interior of the ship. Instantly, the remaining Chinese became tense, and Captain Hawksworth sensed this, for he whipped around, grabbed a belaying pin, and took 3 determined steps toward the men climbing up the gangplank. Cursing them in a language they could not understand, he grabbed the arm of the next Punti, swung him about, and launched him toward the ladder. When the Chinese had sense enough to climb down, the big American roared, "There's gonna be no trouble aboard this ship," and he brandished his belaying pin as the future plantation hands disappeared into the dark hold. As they went below, the Chinese caught a last glimpse of their homeland, and unconsolable sorrows assaulted them, for it was a miserable thing when a man left China, and some sense that never again would they see this great land. No matter how harshly China had treated them, it was still the Middle Kingdom, the heavenly land suspended between mere earth and the residence of the gods. The sweeping plains, the rice fields in the spring, the glorious mountains, and the wild, cruel rivers. It was a land men could love, and for each who now deserted it there came a memory of the village where his ancestral pavilion waited his return. Just before it was Nyuk-tsin's turn to enter the hold, a thoughtful Punti climbed back out to advise Captain Hawksworth that the first man who had been thrown into the ship had broken his ankle. But when the Good Samaritan reached the deck, Hawksworth became furious and clouted the man with his belaying pin, knocking him back into the hold where his friends caught him. "Don't any of you goddamn Chinese pirates come up onto my deck," the captain bellowed. Nyuk-tsin was the last person down the ladder, and as she prepared to descend, she saw Dr. Whipple smiling at her while Captain Hawksworth monitored her with his belaying pin. Beyond them, she caught a last glimpse of China, and when she thought of the brutal way in which this land had murdered her parents, and of the near starvation in which she had lived, and of the archaic terror she had known with her kidnappers, she was glad to see the end of China. Since she was only a woman, her name appeared in no ancestral hall, and there were no ties binding her to the mountains other than the memory of the animal-like loads her uncle had piled upon her. So as she saw her homeland for the last time, she whispered to herself, "Farewell, cursed land. I shall never see you again." Then she saw at the bottom of the ladder the young gambler, Mun Kai, the only person in many years who had been kind to her, and gladly she climbed down to be with him. And she was gratified when he extended his hand to help her, but she did not know that he was doing so to prevent her from breaking a leg, for an accident like that would seriously diminish her value when it came time to sell her in Honolulu. As she reached bottom, the ladder was hauled out and heavy boards were dropped across the opening. When it became apparent that the hold was to be completely closed, the Chinese began a loud wail of protest, and Captain Hawksworth shouted, "Get the muskets." When they were produced, he ordered three sailors to kneel along the edge of the hold, and then he shouted, "Fire!" Shots whistled past the pigtails and crashed into the bulkheads. The terrified Chinese fell to the floor, and the last boards of the covering were hammered into place. Now, only a faltering light filtered in through a narrow grating, and there was no air. But a sail was rigged on deck so that when the ship was in motion, a breeze would be trapped and funneled below. There was no regular supply of water, only one foul bucket for slops, and such bedding as each man had brought of his own, nor were there any blankets for those who tried to sleep. It was in these quarters that Nyuk-tsin started housekeeping with her gambler Mun Kai and his 299 companions. One thing was settled quickly. The Punti took their position forward and the Haka aft, for naturally neither group wished to contaminate itself with the other. And for Nyuk-tsin there was a moment of hesitation when she felt that perhaps she ought to settle down with her own people. But they showed that they wanted nothing to do with a Haka girl who had married a Punti